The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
Here's your games.
Smuggle Truck.
Smuggle Truck.
Yes. Jack Lumber.
Came Smuggle Truck for
yes.
iOS.
Yes.
Jack Lumber.
Currently working on a new game called Discourse, which I will show you. But,
oh, sweet.
Yeah.
And are you going to be able to do Friday games?
I'm not 100% sure.
Okay. All right.
Yes.
We'll email about that if you can.
It's madness. We're running a Kickstarter now. I don't know if anyone here has ever had experience going through the cycle of running a Kickstarter or being part of it, but it's kind of 30 days of not sleeping and constant emails, thousands of emails a day to all of our team, and just kind of all this craziness. So trying to figure all that out and see how it goes. It's a new experience for us.
So Alex is going to be talking about process as it's practiced over in Alchemy Labs. I really like how their company's organized. They do a lot with very few staff in person.
Yes.
In very interesting ways. So take it away.
So I'll do a really quick introduction of my company and myself, and then I have a couple questions for you guys, and then I'll turn it around with some info about process. So I'm Alex, chief scientist, as I call myself, because when you get to make up your own tag at your own company, you just can go crazy. So I call myself the chief scientist or founder or CTO, or CEO, depending on who you want to impress, or sometimes the janitor, which is the truth of running a small company. You kind of have to do it all. Here's a photo of where we work in our labs. This was actually the murder simulation lab at one point, and now is in Intrepid Labs up the street. So yes, we made a game called Snuggle Truck, where you bring a bunch of stuffed animals over a border in a rusty truck in order to get them free healthcare. And there's a whole backstory to that game, but I won't go into it right now. You can ask me later. Our next game is called Jack Lumber. That was a game about a supernatural lumberjack wherein you were trying to get revenge on the trees because a tree killed your granny. So that's why you became a lumberjack and wanted to cut down all the trees. That was a strategy line drawing, time-stopping, bullet-time strategy game, which got us some awards. It was pretty cool. We also worked on a game called Ah, which some of you may have played or know. And that was also in conjunction with Dejabong Games. It's another local independent studio. They built the game. We built the sequel and redid it in Unity and brought it to mobile and then put it on Steam and all that fun stuff. And then we also... So that's a game where you jump off a building and fly through the city collecting points. We also brought that to Oculus Rift recently, which has been an amazing experience, where you can... I'll just say that Vertigo simulates itself in VR as well as it does in real life. So that's a fun thing. There's Eric right there, smacking his head on a pole, which is right behind him. I advise you never to do Oculus testing in a room with close quarters because there's people hitting walls and smacking their head. I digress. So I'm going to talk about process, but I want to ask a couple questions of the group to see kind of where you guys are. So, in general, like, how many years of practicing game development are you at, collectively? Would you say, like, academically or professionally or personally, you've built one project, you've built 10 projects, you've been doing it for 3 years, 1 year. Any feedback on that so I can get a sense of where you guys are? Not all at once.
Less than a year.
Less than a year total of making games. So, and who here is interested in graduating and moving out of academia into AAA games, a.k.a. working at a large game studio, and that's your goal? Interesting. Is anyone here interested in going out and starting their own company to make games on their own or teaming up with a small group of friends and kind of doing that as a endeavor? Okay, some people. Or joining a small studio would be the indie, I guess, joining an indie studio. Okay, so... Everyone else who's not raising their hands, are they just not making games and not interested in games, or don't know, haven't picked, what you're doing? Anyone who hasn't raised their hand, what's kind of your situation?
I'm just not going into the games field.
Okay, so is this kind of, games are one aspect of your, programming, your engineering degree, and you want to do, something else, or?
Or it's more like I wanted to see what it was like. I wanted the experience with it.
Okay.
And the class is pretty good.
Okay, Perfect. I didn't plant you, but that's exactly what I'm going to be talking about today. It's team team management. And one last thing. Has anyone done a co-op or an internship or has done any freelance work at all with anyone making games? So, like, I've done freelance music for a game and it went on the App Store or something. So what have you guys?
So I actually worked that on Trump Pursuits, which I think is, like, right where you guys are.
Yeah, it's, like, 12 feet from us. Yeah.
Yeah, so I did some games for them.
Oh, okay, cool. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yes, yes, I'm familiar. Where are they located again?
San Francisco.
Okay, that's what I thought. Cool. And
we made a Windows Phone game, live action game, where you can run around and collect stuff.
Awesome. That was independent, or you worked with a team?
At Microsoft.
Okay, cool. Sweet. Okay, that's enough questions. I don't want to be all doom and gloom, but it's extremely hard to get a job in the game industry, and it's also extremely hard to succeed as an independent and sell your games and get enough money to hit the low bar of being able to feed yourself and pay rent. That's an achievement that a lot of indies still have not been able to hit. And you see a lot of games out there that you look up to, and you say, like, oh, these guys are amazing, they make all these great games, and they must drive Lamborghinis. And the sad truth is that a lot of those people are barely making rent making these games. And so I just kind of want to go into how we attempt to mitigate that, how we work with our team, as Rick said, how we do a lot or try to do a lot with a very, very small team because we have to keep our burn rate, you know, our monthly output of money to our contractors and employees very low. So I'm going to go into some of that. This is kind of a hodgepodge of different things. So and I want it to be, if you have any questions in the middle, just interrupt me. So I'm not going to try to run through an entire presentation and have you stare at me. Just if you think of something, throw it at me. So one thing is a lot of people ask me, how big is your company? And there's really no good answer for that. So I'm going to break it down, well, with some amazing clip art. We're a heavily project-based, heavily distributed company, and so the scope of the game determines our team size at that moment because we try to do one project and not do multiple concurrent projects at the same time. So we have our core members of Alchemy Labs, and we have a group of freelancers and some auxiliary members, which we're kind of stepping down in number of hours, so full-timers and part-timers, and then kind of, hey, we need you to make a quick website type of dude. So right now, and this was kind of updated yesterday, we have myself and Carrie Witt, who is our first hire at the company in Boston at Intrepid Labs. So our CTO, who is the other full-time member of Alchemy, who is not working on anything else, it's solely Alchemy, he's in Manitoba. He's in Winnipeg, actually an hour outside of Winnipeg. So if you think about how small Winnipeg is, and then go about an hour through the snow to the middle of nowhere, that's where he is. So if you have internet, you can kind of get away with working with people around the world, and I'm going to talk about how we do that. And he brought on board someone for Discourse, the game we're currently developing, who's also in Winnipeg. So we kind of have this Winnipeg office to some extent, although they're not working together in an office. So there's four people. Recently we hired someone in Florida, and he takes care of all of our prior projects, which is a new thing for us. So we have Jack Lumber, we have Snuggle Truck, we have Ah, we have Oculus, and we're on all these platforms because part of our strategy is to be on Steam for Mac and PC and Linux and on Android and on iPhone and everywhere. And that is great because you get money from each of those distribution channels, but it takes a lot of time, and you get a lot of people bitching about things not working or, hey, I just updated to Mavericks in the beta before it was even out, and your game doesn't work there. And so just having to deal with and field questions about all the platforms you support, you know, I'm on Ubuntu 10. Whatever, you know, they've made up a new name, Gusty Gibbon something. But like, it, you know, I'm not getting any video here in this brand of Linux. And so we need someone to help that's not just support and just funneling things to us to fix, but he knows all of our projects, knows our code base, and is basically kind of the Uber repairman / developer of all things. And he's remote as well, so that's five people. Our community manager, who some of you may know, was the community manager at Harmonix, Eric Chan. He left there, and then now he does freelance community management. And what I mean by that is he's doing Twitter, Facebook, outreach, blog posts, engaging with fans, talking to people on the Kickstarter, all that kind of stuff. And so he does that for Alchemy and Blue Manchu, which is another indie studio. They make Card Hunter, which isn't out yet, but you may have heard of it. And so he is doing that, and he just moved to Irvine, California because of his wife. So he was local, but now we have another person that's remote. So even more and more people are remote at the company. And that doesn't even include Jason, who's doing music for Discourse, Takumi, who I went to college with, who is now in Australia, who does all of our web design, Kenneth, who was at BioWare, but is now writing for Discourse as a contractor, and then any extra art that our artist brings in, her RISD buddies, and like, oh, we need this little commissioned art piece. So there's all these kind of different people that I have to get them to sign, you know, a 1099, or you know, they're getting a 1099 from me as far as being paid. So that's alchemy. And how do we communicate with all these people? Especially, you know, some of them were in different time zones. And there's nights and weekends work, and we don't try to set we set core hours, so we try to be like 11 to 4. Hopefully you're around. But if you want to get your stuff done on a Saturday, or you want to work late or work early, it doesn't matter to us as long as you get things done. And that's kind of the key factor for working with people remotely, is they need to be driven and get things done. So we use all these tools, and I'll go through each one. So this sounds really geeky, but the most exciting tool we use, and it's such an epiphany and such an amazing thing to have now, and I don't know if you guys have used Trello, but it's basically Google Docs for tasks, but we use it for everything. Anything we ever need to remember, if you're like opening a text document and putting it on your right screen and writing like, oh, I better do this, you're doing it wrong. You should be using Trello, because everyone else can see, depending on whether you know have private or public. We have a Trello for alchemy projects. Everyone can see the new posts you put up there. It's all real-time live. You could drag someone's face onto a task and say, hey, you probably should have done this, you know, blog post or whatever. When he does it, he completes it, and then it poofs away on all of our screens. It's the best way to work with a bunch of people and not have to tell them verbally or write an email about every single thing that's happening. For example, you could also attach images and have like a whole chat in one task. So if Carrie, our artist, draws something for an image, and then we say, hey, it needs like a little change here, and then she attaches a new one, that whole conversation happened within a Trello card, and you didn't just flood your email with 20 emails back and forth with people who didn't care or weren't involved. And it's just such a much better way to work together. So if you're going to do nothing else, I'd say use Trello. Google Docs, we use that all the time. That's pretty self-explanatory. We use Dropbox for large binary files and source art, also collecting any PR mentions, any publicity, all of our press kit screenshots. It's amazing how when you're just releasing a very small bit of information, how it turns into, you know, 50 pieces of content all at different sizes, and the Photoshop file and the PSD and the PNG version at this size for the blog and this size for this, and it just, you have to archive it everywhere. Interviews, website content, everything that's not the code for the game or the actual the art that's being used in the game goes on Dropbox. Skype video, it's horrible. I mean, but everyone uses it. It's kind of a standard. I mean, we could use Hangout, but it does a pretty poor job of filtering out your own voice when you're talking to people, so I always hear echo, at least when I'm talking. And Skype has some processing to get rid of it. So we use Skype all the time. And one of us paid for a pro, and then we can host, you know, 5-person Skype chats, so it's really useful. And group chats, I would say, are a very important thing. If you're not using Skype group chats to communicate, or, I mean, you could use IRC chat rooms and things like that, but group chats are super important when you're working remotely with people, because if you hit the call button on Skype, that means that even if they're in the middle of a thought programming, you don't know what they're doing, you know, out in the middle of nowhere programming, you could be interrupting something really important. So it's better to use a passive mode of communication, like saying, hey, if you have a second, I want to chat, and then maybe 2 minutes later he says, okay, let's get on a call. That is much more considerate, and it ends up not slowing down people. So I highly recommend that. And if you're using AIM or some other method of text communication, same deal. Just calling someone, or if they're sitting next to you, saying like, hey, right in the middle of their thought can really mess things up. So I highly recommend a ping through text before bugging someone. Our version control, as our asset server that we use for Unity, we have it send emails every time someone commits. So, and we try to enforce really good commit messages so that people are up to date on what everyone else is working on and how it's going. And especially if it's like, don't update to this update, it will break half of your things. You know, make sure that's bolded and everyone's reading that. And, you know, getting together, casual get-togethers, indies, PAX, game jams, those are super important for us to kind of make sure you get that face-to-face time, because even with Skype, there's some breakdown of communication sometimes when you're not with someone in the same room, and it's good to kind of sync up again every once in a while. And so I pulled this from a talk that I did recently. It was I had a section about know how to work with humans, and I kind of want to just run through this. So it was about remote work, and Rick said that this should be helpful for some of you guys, because what I was saying about it's hard to get a job in games, you might find yourself trying to find a job and unable to do so, and it's kind of that catch-22 of, I don't have the experience to have that, you know, I need 3 years with ship titles to get into this studio, but I need to get that experience. And so putting yourself out there as a freelancer, doing whatever it is you do, level design, art creation, music, coding, it doesn't matter. You can freelance and work for a bunch of different clients at once. I think it's an understatement to say, yeah, just go freelance. That's really, really important to know how to do it and how to pull it off. And I could talk for days about proper freelancing techniques, and you could look at clients from hell about all the problems that people have working with clients. But this, if you're going to be a remote worker for another company freelancing, or you want to make an indie game and have someone else join your project and they're going to be remote, you have to think about whether they're the right person for that. So, recently the Yahoo CEO said no remote workers at Yahoo. She made an edict and that affected thousands of people. And I think she has no idea what she was talking about. And I think remote work vastly increases productivity for the right types of people. But trying to figure out who those people are is tough. So, if you are a company or an individual trying to work with remote people, the benefits of doing that is that you can work with the best people in the world. You don't have to say, who's available in my area of the Northeast, or how can I pay for them to relocate? Honestly, paying for people to relocate, unless the studio is fairly large, is not going to happen. So how can you work with these employees or these people around the world remotely? So you could get a happier employee who can spend their time wisely with family and have flexibility and have less time wasted commuting. That's all the positives of remote. But can everyone be a remote worker? No. And I think a good remote worker needs to have drive to create great work on their own. They need to have really, really strong communication and social skills. And they have to have the flexibility to deal with things that crop up, especially when they're happening on another time zone. So our community managers in California, and we just launched a big press release this morning at 9 a.m. Eastern, which is kind of the standard. If you're going to announce something to Joystick, Kotaku, you know, Destructoid, Rock, Paper, Shotgun, you need to get it out. East Coast, 9 a.m. So that means he has to wake up at 6 or 5 if he's going to have an hour leading up to that 9 a.m. to help me send this out to hundreds of press. And that's something that, you know, normally, at a company, you wouldn't ask someone to, hey, can you wake up at 5 to go do something? But when you're working remotely, that might be something you have to do. We try not to do it often, but you need to find people who are able to do something like that. And someone who can take feedback. Because, as I said, when you talk to someone over Skype or especially text, you lose a lot of that nuance about what you're saying. And so if you're already kind of not so great at taking feedback, when you give feedback over text, people will just get angry and they assume things that are negative about your work. Like especially in art, when it's kind of floaty and you say like, oh, I don't like the way that looks, can you change that? That can easily come off as a really, really asshole comment, right? So you have to be careful about people who are good at critiquing or have gotten, you know, years of experience getting critiques and things like that. So how do we work more effectively with our remote workers? Devin and I, the guy who I mentioned who's our CTO, we leave Skype video open almost all day. And so in this big shared office I have two monitors, and on the left monitor I have Devin just kind of sitting there. If he's going to get up and like make lunch, he just walks away. And if I'm going to go get a coffee or something, he is sitting there doing some work, and my desk is empty with a big face of Devin sitting there. And a lot of people in the office know him and will sit down in my chair and say hi and be like, hey, man, how's it going? And I think it's just, it's kind of funny to think about that second monitor as like the digital presence of someone who's across the world. The Trello thing, the company-wide Skype chats, as I mentioned. Morning stand-ups we've been pretty bad about doing, but I think it's pretty important just to get everyone in the morning, say, what are you trying to accomplish today? Just let us know, and then you can go on your way. Try to keep the process overhead as low as possible, but you need trustworthy people to not have to over micromanage. Shared notebooks, it's not that important, but flexible schedule, developer guides. We build developer guides for any programmer that's going to work on a project of ours. So there's a lot of like weird things we've done in this project. We document all that and get it up front. We tell them how they should be committing every night. Even if their code is broken, they should make it so it doesn't break the project and commit every night, because we had problems with remote people working for days on a long task. Like, he's building some large thing, and he's not committing. And I'm sure some of you have dealt with this on projects with, group members. Someone goes 5 days trying to build something, and things have changed so drastically since they started working on this feature. Now you have people out of sync, and I just remember in this specific case, this guy was trying to build this animation in one of our games that was kind of the intro to the gameplay. And it was a really complex thing with a character flying out of a moving RV and like dust particles and screeching brakes, and then he lands and then the game starts. And it like touches all these different systems. And he was coding all this, and he was having problems and generating new bugs left and right. And we were like, how's that coming, man? We haven't talked to you in days. And he said, oh, not very good. Let me show you what I have. And it's just, he had hundreds of files changed in our source tree. And what he built wasn't really working. And so we ended up having to roll back the entire way and kind of start over. And I think that was definitely caused by the fact that he was not communicating well. He wasn't saying, hey, I'm having some trouble here. It could have been something that Devin would have known in 1 second and fixed it up for him. But instead, he went 5 days kind of wallowing in his own sorrow of not being able to fix whatever he was trying to fix, didn't tell us about it, had all these changed files and wasn't committing, and then it ended up being a nightmare. So that kind of is a good exemplary case of all the things about a remote worker not going well. I have a whole section here about getting people on board on a rev share basis, which is kind of giving royalties on a game that made money. You can give a percentage to a project member, or paying them flat rate up front. I'm not sure if this is interesting to the audience at the moment, but I would love to just take general questions about anything you guys are thinking at the moment while I scroll through here and see if there's something that may be of use. There's a ton of these little like snippets of cautionary tales that I have in another presentation that was like, someone who offers to work for you for free, it's never free. Free is never free. It might take such an amazing amount of time to get them up to speed, or all these different problems with working with free people. The idea that if they're working for free, you don't need a contract with them. It's just, this could be like a company-ruining failure on your part if you don't have a contract set up with someone that is contributing content to a game for free. If anyone's seen Indie Game the movie, and the whole thing about Phil Fish and, those guys just didn't have any contracts with each other, and then they started bitching, and then it turned into, hey, we're getting sued by each, we're each suing each other, and now we can't show it at PAX. It's just a big nightmare. Working with great talent. So some of the cautionary notes, this could be useful for you guys. Do not update a plugin that is important to your game right before shipping your product. I've seen so many people do this, and I don't know what's going through their mind at the time. Like, especially, I'll speak from my experience in Unity, with the asset store and plugins being used that are fairly integrated into your project, like a 2D system or a plugin for any kind of like third-party thing, like Game Center on an iOS game or any like auxiliary thing. Don't just update it and expect it to work. Oh, man, I've seen so many projects go headfirst into the ground because of just someone saying, oh, there's a new update for blah? Sure, like, why not? And it's the early adopter mindset does not apply when you're trying to ship something. You can't do that. You have to be really conservative near the end of the project. So if you're near the end of your cycle right now and you're trying to finish up a game, don't make drastic changes. Don't upgrade your operating system 2 days before you need to ship a game. Don't update plugins, all that. And then back to the thing about Skype and how we make all these... You know, we're talking over Skype all year, and I see Devin twice a year, maybe. Once at GDC, once at PAX. And so all of our major decisions, things about the company direction, all that is made over Skype. Numbers about how much we're going to pay each other, about percentages, really important stuff. And we do it all over voice chat, and then sometimes we forget to write it down. and we're trying to get better at that, but when you're working with remote people, you need to have good documentation of everything you said, unless you rig up some kind of video recording, or you know, you're streaming everything you say to Twitch, and you could go back and look at it. Otherwise, you should really write it down. So that's what I have for you, hoping you guys can throw out some random questions and I can help. Yeah.
I guess, like, especially since you guys are all over the place, like, how do you make sure everyone sort of has the same mission of, like, what they're supposed to be making for this game?
So we have design meetings that are usually between Carrie, myself, and Devin, which so it's like the core three people, and then but we try to build games. I think someone was telling me recently. They said, I love the way... Oh, it was Michael Carrier. So he runs the Indie Game Collective. He's head of Boston Indies in the area. And he was saying, I really love how when you set up Jack Lumber, and he contributed to Jack Lumber. He said, it was so easy to understand when I was building something, what should I do or how should I style it? Or maybe like if I needed to write some text or write some dialogue here, what would I write? Because you had set up such a funny, insane scenario with Jack and wanting to kill all the trees because the revenge about his grandma, and that we had thought about that and set up this scenario so that anytime he needed to draw something, write something, implement something, he knew how it should feel because it would all branch off that key premise. And so we try to set a style for ourselves, even though we've done a physics-based racing game, a strategy line drawing game, and now a dynamic simulation of narrative on a like in a survival type game, all three of which you could tell are our games because of the style. And so hopefully people know what they're supposed to be doing and are on board with the vision of the project because we try to keep it really tight and very specific in how it should feel. So,
do you give people quite a bit of freedom, like tell them, oh, make a new log in
Plumber
or something like that?
Oh, yeah. We give them an incredible amount of freedom, but you can only get to that point when you've worked with someone so long or you trust them at such a level that you understand that they're 100% in sync with what you're thinking. So Carrie, since she's a core member of the team, the artist, we just tell her general things. Like, we knew that we wanted a desert scape in Discourse, so let me pull up an image here. So I didn't really describe Discourse in any way, but I'll show you. Okay, so can I scroll here? Yeah. Okay, so in Discourse, you play as Rita, an overeducated art school graduate who has found herself as a full-time barista making latte art. She was on a plane, and unfortunately the plane crashed. And so she was stuck with a bunch of other travelers. And so she was on this plane with, if you think about when you're on a plane, who are the annoying people near you, right? Like there's someone kicking the seat back of your chair, and there's like the super touristy people with their Lonely Planet guides and their fanny packs. And there's like, you know, there might be an air marshal, or there's this conspiracy theorist dude. And so all these kind of tropes and things. And they're all stuck on an island together trying to survive and get off the island. But it kind of, there's this element of like infighting. It's kind of like, what's a bigger danger? You know, you dying from the elements or you you know, conflicting with your group, and so it's about making moral decisions in this group and trying to get out alive. Anyway, we would say we want this general area, and she would come up with, because she's a hybrid designer and artist, she would come up with the concept for what she wanted, so like a tree or a bush or, you know, things that would be in this desert area, this kind of like lake with a shimmering effect. She would come up with it, sketch it in a notebook, show it to us in Trello, which we, you know, we're not really saying much other than, yeah, it looks amazing, paint it in Photoshop, and then we had built an art, a tech art pipeline, which would allow that Photoshop file, PSD, to be brought right into Unity, and then a quad would be made out of that element. Since everything is done in, it's a 3D game, but everything is 2D planes, she's able to get the entire model set up the collision, arrange the level. So she's a level designer, she's an artist, and then she animates the individual elements to kind of give it a good feel. So we give her so much freedom, and everyone on the team has that amount of freedom, so that when, because we don't want a central head, you know, person saying, here's exactly all my ideas and they should be represented in the game like this. It's kind of a collaborative effort, and you can't really get away with that at a really large scale. So it's something we can do with, you know, four or five people doing that, but you can't do that at a major, you know, full-size company. So here's... okay, well, this might be a good example. I don't know if it'll work when I hit play.
Can you just upgrade?
Yeah, I upgraded all my plugins right before I came here. Yeah, here we go. So let me just maximize. Okay, so here's a quick scene, and I can tumble in the scene view and show you what all the assets are flat, right? And this is being rendered kind of, you know, with an isometric camera in Unity. And then what's some cool, interesting things here is that if you notice, the all of the items are casting shadows against the alpha cutout of the shape. So it's not like we modeled the shape of that tree. It's just Carrie painted it, and the alpha channel determines where the solid, the line between solid and, you know, opaque and transparent is. So if I go in here and change the lighting, I can give a better example of how this will be really, really cool here. Let's see. There you go. So all this is dynamic. We have a, you know, day-night cycle that affects time of day and things like that. But as far as the question about giving, you know, people the freedom to build what they want to build, obviously there has to be some kind of vetting. If someone comes up with an insane idea, hopefully the other two people or other three people will say, oh, that's completely impossible to build, or maybe it doesn't fit with what we're trying to do. But if everyone's kind of on board, then we go forward. So yeah, I'll just continue showing cool things on the screen while anyone else comes up with questions. Yes?
Have you ever run into the conflicts of interest with your domain manager, and how would you solve those? Seems like he's working for another company as well. Like, is there any time he has, like, maybe you have to launch on the same day as another?
Oh, yeah. Actually, it's kind of the opposite. So sometimes we'll mention something about Card Hunter on Alchemy's Twitter, just because. And as far as, like, us sharing his time and, you know, oh, I need him from... I would never say, hey, I need you 100% of the time during these hours. It's just kind of... it's up to him to balance that. And if he's not able to get his stuff done, or he's letting us down in some way there, then we would address it at that time. But in general, the concept that, like, a freelancer or someone working remotely that's not full-time, we assume they're doing other projects, and we encourage the fact that they're working on other stuff and have side work going on. And as long as it doesn't conflict with, you know, what we're trying to do. So we haven't come up with major problems like that, like conflict of interest or anything like that. In fact, any press contact he gets, you know, if he has a friend at Joystick, he'll probably reach out to them about our projects and about the other company's projects. So it's just a win-win.
So probably the most disruptive thing is if your community manager or any of your freelancers gets a full-time job anywhere. That
yes.
That would be the
yeah.
most disruptive thing.
Yeah. So as far as retaining the people we are working with, The big thing is that we try to build the games that we would love to make, and by giving the people we're working with the creative freedom to kind of be there at the ground level, building these, you know, feeling like they're a part of something awesome, usually we can, that kind of beats out everything else. So when balancing out, like, I'm going to be part of this amazing game that I know people are going to, you know, like, thousands, hundreds of thousands of people are going to see, and my art's going to be on the front of Joystick and Kotaku. I'm not too worried about Carrie leaving to do art, you know, for another corporate entity, because she's getting all of her creative needs fulfilled, and she loves working with us. And so we basically just need to do well by our employees and contractors, and hopefully that'll, you know, keep them in-house. The only time we've had someone leave was we had a designer named Kate, and so she was always a huge BioShock fan. And she had won all these like community contests for like build a, you know, cosplay for you know, Big Daddy or whatever. And so she was kind of like famous among the 2K Irrational community, and she was working for us, and she worked on Jack Lumber. And then she got a full-time job offer by 2K Publishing out in Redwood City in California. And they were offering her, and so she had a kid and a new husband, and they offered to take her out there and pay her like triple what any small studio could ever pay. It was just kind of this dream opportunity. And so everyone kind of agreed, hey, that's 100%, just go for it. Like, this is your dream thing, working for 2K and all that. So other than that extreme case, we, you know, the people we're working with hopefully are happy doing what they're doing and keep it that way.
So, question about your task management system. Like, are you using a formal Scrum? Are you doing any formal Scrum stuff, or is it very off the cuff?
It's extremely off the cuff. We have categories here. Hopefully, I'm not showing any really horrible things. So here's like, I'm offline, but here's the discourse Trello, and here's Carrie's stuff that she's working on. And we have a really poor schedule here because Google Calendar integration is not so great. But this is kind of what are we doing during the Kickstarter to make sure that people are engaged on these days. And then this is about what we're building in the day one scenario in the game itself. And this is just for the discourse project. And you can see here I have these bookmarks for each of the crazy things that I'm working on. And so I have personal ones for my own thing, and then we have a Alchemy business one, and the third party one is kind of what that guy Andrew in Florida is working on. So any requests that come in to fix XYZ on the Linux build, they go in there, get categorized and sorted. But no, we're not following a methodology at the moment, which might be a downfall.
Do you have milestones?
Yes.
Like,
so milestones are
milestones from somebody, not you?
They're almost always around conferences. So almost every one of our milestones is we need to build together to. So we're going to demo our next game at PAX East 2014 in the Indie Mega Booth. So that'll be April. So we need fully playable, you know, 15-minute sit-down, headphone, keyboard experience, polished and ready for that. And then we'll break it down from there and hopefully have some sub milestones between what we have now and like demo ready. But yes, it's usually having to show something at Boston Postmortem or Boston Indies, having to show at going to, you know, GDC or PAX or all that. So going to conferences acts as a good kick in the ass to get milestones set up. But yeah. We don't create artificial milestones just like on some day. But it just happens that we have various things happening paced out throughout the year that help us do that. So, yeah. Yeah.
So it's very interesting that your process seems very, I guess, like, haphazard and depends on, like, people's interests. Mm-hmm. So do you have some sort of, like how far do you plan into the future of, like, oh, we should have this feature by this time, it should be pretty book free, and I'm going to add this, and then
I would say the distance out that we're planning about actual in-game features at that level, the lower like technical level, is lower than in any game we've done before, which is usually interesting. People start like as they mature in the industry, they do more and more planning. But what's interesting with this game is that we're changing our development style, and we're doing it openly in a Kickstarter publicly. So that changes a lot of things, and we didn't want to get too far ahead of ourselves before people could see the game and react to it, and then possibly hear, you know, a bunch of negative feedback about one certain thing that we thought was great. So we want to kind of hear what people are thinking before we plan out too much of the game. So there's that. but yeah, I mean...
So you think like maybe like a week ahead
usually? Oh no, we have things in there that are a couple months ahead and what we need to have. I mean, we're thinking about packs already because, you know, at this point you have to already start buying flights to GDC and all that stuff. So now that's become real to us. So going to San Francisco in March and showing this game is now a milestone in the distance. So we're thinking about what goals we have and what we want to show. You know, are we showing this to Sony for PS4 inclusion? If so, what do they want to see, right? I think we're thinking about it from a business standpoint about what do we need to show, who are we trying to impress. For PAX, it's going to be we want people to sit down, play for 10 minutes, understand all the branching narrative in a very short amount of time, and realize that their choices have consequence in the shortest amount of time possible. And that's the goal. And so we're going to try to make a demo that proves that. So
you have like that end goal, and you also have a lot of steps in between where you let people sort of handle it, like, okay, this is our vision, so we need to get here by this time.
Yeah.
This is the way you need to do it.
We'll maybe once a week we'll sit down again and then generate the next 2 or 3 weeks of tasks based on where we are and what we see, kind of like what's developing. Because there's a lot of things in the game, because it's not like building a contract project. When you're contracted to do something and someone says, here's the design for the game, it's going to be an infinite runner, you're going to have 10 levels, you're going to have the character can slide and jump and do this and he can shoot these things and whatever. You have a full spec and it's on paper and you can say, okay, we're going to get here's our alpha and our beta, and then milestone, you know, before that it's milestone 1, 2, and 3 where we're going to have first playable and then we'll have, you know, blah, blah, blah. And you'd plan it all out and then you'd go for that. When we're designing and writing the game at the same time, which is one of the hardest things about trying to do like something in a new genre. So we're trying to blend genres and make something weird. And the same thing happened with Jack Lumber. It's really hard to plan ahead because we would throw away a month's worth of work when we realized we had a better way to do something or a better way that the player would feel like this was juicier and better and more fun. We would throw away the old way and do it again. So it's almost dangerous to plan too much ahead, and you want to try to get the core gameplay solid as early as possible and then figure out what those next steps are. But that rule doesn't necessarily apply to... It depends on what kind of project you're building. You know, if you have 4 weeks and it's a student project, you better know exactly what day everyone's doing everything up to that point once you've kind of figured out your design, because you don't have a lot of time to iterate in really small projects. So usually you just kind of pick a path and hope it's going to work, and you go, and then usually you get there and you go, ah, crap, I wish I was there, and it's too late. So, story of our lives. Yeah.
Oh, so when you start planning a project, after you have an idea, how do you guys figure out like, how many people you want on your team? And as you're going through the course of the project, do you think about adding more people to the team or adjusting to that?
Yeah.
And also, I guess, how do you get your idea in the first place? Do you guys are working like very like separated environment, like, so does one person come up with it, or how do you guys generate the game?
It's there's a lot of ways that the ideas come up, but like the nicest, most interesting way for me to explain it and simplest is to ignore all the other kind of inputs. You know, you read a lot of books and you watch movies and you think of things and you think, you know, oh, I'm playing Minecraft at this time, maybe I like this, I'm playing Don't Starve, blah blah blah. It's kind of like over months you kind of generate ideas and write them down in a book and all that. But I think the best way to say it is every year we go to a cabin in the woods in Vermont as at least Devin and myself, but usually Carrie and then like a bunch of other indie developers. We call it Indie Cabin. And then that's where we had an original prototype of Jack Lumber, and that's where we came up with like the actual idea, because we had all these bad ideas before then. And at the cabin, it kind of solidified into a real game. And then the next one, we came up with Discourse at the cabin. So we're starting a trend where... my answer to you is we come up with it at a cabin in the woods every year. I think that just sounds so much better than like, oh, we think about stuff kind of, and then maybe we think of something. So, and then you, the other thing you asked was about how do you know who's going to be on the team when you're first starting? You don't want to just bring all six people on day one. That's a nightmare because you don't know exactly what you're building. You're trying to flesh it out, and then you have to start paying all these people, and they might not have anything to do. You have to get to the point where you're so overstressed doing that thing yourself that now it's time to offload it to someone who could do it better. And so with Discourse, we were writing all this fake narrative, and then we said, oh, we really need a writer. And so we were shopping around to try to find someone who had a kind of humorous style in writing and that could pull off what we were trying to do. And then we found someone, and then we kind of told him, hey, we won't need you for another maybe 2 months or so. And then, you know, he was on board with doing the project, and then we told him exactly when we wanted his first deliverable once we really, really needed it. So it's important to not just kind of get antsy and say, like, oh, I really want to work with this dude, therefore I'm going to, like, hire him. And then what? You know, it's just there's a lot of awkward pauses in the beginning of development when you don't know what you're doing, and that costs money. So you have to slowly onboard people at the right time, which is really hard to do. But you kind of have to, if you have a lot of generalists, you could do everything yourself really crappily and then have it done, you know, redone better by other people later.
So do you start off with an idea of how much you're going to need for a project, or do you kind of figure it out as you
go? It's usually balloons as you go, yeah. When you realize something's so terrible in your game that you probably need a whole person to fix it, then you have to start looking for that person. That's why being in an area where there's a lot of game developers, like in Boston, it helps with that network. So if you say, like, oh, I really need a musician who can make island-themed music, you know, being in Boston, that's you could do that. You could find those people. And if you didn't have those connections or you were in the middle of nowhere and you just didn't know musicians, it might be more difficult. So that's why I try to get, you know, my advice to everyone is to get out there, go to those game developer meetups and just introduce yourself and hear what other people are working on and just be generally interested in other people's projects. And then you might think of them later on when you might either want to bring them on board of one of your projects or you want to work with them or they hire you. Or it's just a very small industry, and so it's good to just know what people are good at so that it might be useful in the future.
Is this the largest team that you've got, that you've had in Alchemy, or what's a larger project?
The end of Jack Lumber was pretty big, but again, it's hard to measure in person hours. So Jack Lumber had a lot of people that were doing minimal hours. Like we had Eric Sutman doing level design on Jack Lumber, so he was building all the any logs that come flying up. We had a level editor, and he would do that. And so he worked 60 hours a week for like 4 weeks, and then 2 hours a week for the rest of the time, or just kind of nothing. Because there was a point where we had a couple example levels and it was going okay, and then we're like, okay, now we need all the levels. And so he just kind of went full bore and built them all. So that's what makes it hard to say, like, oh, was he part-time on the project? It's like, well, he was almost nothing on the project, and then over full-time, and then back to not being needed anymore. So everything's kind of a weird blend.
It seems to me that communication, the way how you communicate changes when you cross certain points in terms of how many people are involved, even if they're involved minimally.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you feel that in any of your projects, where it's like, oh, the moment we brought on this one extra person, the team just suddenly became a lot more complicated to communicate with.
Yeah, I mean, the methods we're using, again, they don't scale very well necessarily, and not all the methods we're using. So when you do get to a large number, it might get not so great. One thing we did in Jack Lumber, once we had a bunch of people, we held a game jam called the Log Jam. And we had just eight people all on the project kind of come in, and we came up with some ideas because we were trying to generate new log types and come up with the later stage design. And so it helped get everyone in one room. Because I'd say the hardest thing to do remotely over Skype and communicate with people is to design. I'd say everything else is easier than design, but design just ends up being a lot of what sounds like arguing, because everyone has different thoughts, and it's hard to arrive at a brilliant concept without hitting on 20 shitty things before you get there. And so that's going through those 20 crappy ideas is tough and disappointing until you hit something that works. So I'd say that's the majority of the time we're on Skype disagreeing is probably over a design thing. I don't know if that's helpful, but design is extremely hard, and just be prepared for if you have more than one person designing a concept for butting heads, and you should know what other people's kind of tendencies are when it comes to negotiation and working with those people, so that you can kind of sense when they're feeling frustrated. And that's why like text is useless in that case. Like, you need to see the person and see that they're getting visibly frustrated to be able to change how you're talking to them and things like that. So
I'm not,
yeah, thank you. Hopefully it's useful.
So yeah, so like usual, the rest of the class period is for breaking up into your groups and finishing on your work.